This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
A Purdue University Northwest professor in the Hammond campus has put out a new book that is one of interest that if you happen to remember when Mitch Daniels was the governor of Indiana, how he was involved in this. And Professor David Detmer is with us to talk about his book, which is now out to be checked out. And Professor Detmer, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us a little bit about, tell us, if you will, about the title of the book, Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. And how does that happen to bring a person named Howard Zinn together with Mitch Daniels?
Okay. The way this happened, back in 2013, there was a reporter for the Associated Press who did a Freedom of Information Act search of the emails of Mitch Daniels from when he had been governor. And he came upon an email that Mitch Daniels put out when Howard Zinn died. And for people who are not familiar with Howard Zinn, he was a historian who wrote a best-selling book called A People's History of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, in Mitch Daniels' email, he said, I think that's a terrible book. I don't think it should be used for credit anywhere in the state of Indiana. In fact, I'm going to quote directly. I'm looking at the email right now.
Okay.
He said, can someone assure me that it is not in use anywhere in Indiana? If it is, how do we get rid of it before more young people are force-fed a totally false version of our history? And so I got interested in this, and I started researching it. And one of the things Mitch Daniels did to justify his action was to say, well, you don't have to take my word for it that Howard Zinn was a bad historian who wrote a bad book. There are a number of historians and other scholars who say the same. And so I started reading and researching their work, and I found that it was just larded with errors. They would misquote Zinn. They would say, well, he never says X when he really does say X. Just lots and lots of mistakes. And so the title of the book is just a pun on his name. Xenophobia with an X is, you know, fear of foreigners, essentially. And so I then took Zinn's name, Xenophobia, to reflect the attitude of Mitch Daniels and these other scholars. And there was this sort of battle over this particular book.
What did people seem to feel was wrong, and in particular, I guess, Mitch Daniels, about Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States?
Yeah, what was different about Zinn's book is traditional American history books tend to very much glorify the deeds of our presidents and military leaders and business leaders. And I think from Zinn's point of view, they had something of a patriotic bias, you might say, not willing to fully confront the bad side of our history. And so in Zinn's work, it's called A People's History, and I guess there are really sort of two sides to that. One is wanting to acknowledge the suffering sometimes that the ordinary people had endured at the hands of these leaders. That's number one. And then number two, the book makes an argument that significant progress has tended to be initiated from below by the people rather than from the top by presidents and so on. But back to the first point, just to give an illustration, the first chapter of Zinn's book is about Columbus, and he quotes from Columbus's journal. Now, I don't have this right in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing,
no.
But in Columbus's journal, he says things like the Arawak people that he had met. He says, oh, they're handsome people, they're friendly, they're generous, they're eager to share everything they have. With 50 men, we could subjugate the whole lot of them and enslave the entire island. And in Zinn's account, it proceeds to talk about how Columbus enslaved Indians and killed many of them who didn't give him enough gold and so on. And people like Mitch Daniels are offended by that. They see it as anti-American. So I think that's sort of the main criticism that people have had of Zinn's work.
Has it been the case where, as you say, it's just one person's opinion or maybe a group of people's opinion against Howard Zinn and then the way that he put that book together?
Oh, yes, Mitch Daniels is far from alone. So I think it's fair to say that many people who identify with the conservative wing of American political opinion, they tend to prefer a more quote-unquote patriotic approach to history, so they tend not to like it. And then among professional historians, it's a little bit different. And one of the things that Mitch Daniels said in defending himself is he said, hey, it's not just people on the right, conservatives, who have criticized Zinn. There are people of other political persuasions who have done so as well. And he's right about that. And I think their part of the explanation is not so much political conservatism as professional conservatism. And what I mean by that is historians have been trained. There's a certain way to do history. There are certain subjects you tend to emphasize and other things you de-emphasize. And Zinn was doing it differently than, you know, the role models they learned when they were in graduate school. So it sort of looked wrong. It looked as if Zinn had an axe to grind. And so I think that's part of why they criticized it. But I do want to emphasize that although Zinn has many critics, he also has a great many admirers, including among professional historians. He's gotten a lot of praise from some historians and won some awards and things of that nature. And that book is a phenomenal publishing success. It sold over 2 million copies, and that's very rare for a history book.
In fact, you mentioned one of his greatest supporters, and there's a quote that's in the book here from author Noam Chomsky. He's an amazing person in his own right, too.
Yes, he is. Noam Chomsky, for people not familiar with him, he's a linguist from MIT and often considered to be the most important figure in that discipline in history. He really revolutionized the discipline. And he's also, you might say, a polymath, someone who's made important contributions to many fields. My field, incidentally, is philosophy. I'm a professor of philosophy, and Chomsky is very highly regarded among philosophers. He's done very important work in that field. He's done important work in mathematics, computer science. So he's quite an amazing figure.
We're talking with David Detmer. He's a professor of philosophy, as you just mentioned, at Purdue University Northwest in Hammond. He's been on the faculty there at the Hammond campus since 1989, and he has just written another book, and this one is entitled Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. What's interesting is that you mentioned then-governor, now former governor, and now Purdue University president, Mitch Daniels. At the time that he was governor, he was very much against Zinn's book, and I guess made some very concerted efforts to be sure that it was banned in Hoosier schools, I understand.
That is correct. And so, those emails, as I mentioned, have been published, and he did instruct his subordinates to look into this. And what he ended up, there was a kind of back and forth with his subordinates, and they ended up saying, well, we should do, I'm looking at it right now, we should undertake a review of university courses across the state. This would, quote, force to daylight a lot of excrement. And then Daniels replied, go for it, disqualify propaganda. So they had this whole exchange where they talked about trying to in some way make sure the book was not being used for credit. Now, as it turns out, once this was exposed, I think Mitch Daniels was a bit embarrassed because most of the national publicity was negative. The thought was, you know, this is censorship. It's not really appropriate for a governor to be interfering with educational decisions about which books are being used. And so here's an interesting thing about it. He then claimed that the articles in the press had misrepresented his emails. He said, I wasn't talking about the university. I was only talking about K through 12 education. Yes, at the university, professors can teach anything they want. But when you look at the actual emails, it's hard to sustain that interpretation because he starts out, he quotes from an obituary that says that Zinn's book is, quote, the textbook of choice in high schools and colleges around the country. And then Daniel says, can someone assure me that it is not in use anywhere in Indiana? And he doesn't say anything about, you know, K through 12 as opposed to the university. And then when one of his subordinates comes back and says, well, I've gone online and I've found that it's being used in a course at Indiana University, then Daniel says, well, we can't have that. We've got to disqualify that. So it appears that his claim that he was only talking about K through 12 is not true. The actual emails do not sustain that interpretation.
Now you go now to 2018. We have former Governor Mitch Daniels, now the president of Purdue University. What's, as far as we know, his current thinking about Mr. Howard Zinn and about his book, People's History of the United States?
I don't think he has commented on it in recent years. Mm-hmm. When the controversy came out, as I say, he tried to make this claim he was not talking about the university. So he said things like, if anybody at Purdue wants to teach Howard Zinn, I won't interfere with it. And if Howard Zinn were a faculty member at Purdue, I would let him pursue his research without interfering with him, and so on. So he said all of those things when this whole story was exposed. But to my knowledge, he hasn't really addressed the controversy since then. There was, at that time, there were some professors at the West Lafayette campus who wrote an open letter to more or less protest what Daniels had done, and he wrote a kind of reply to that, and in that reply he made some of these points I've mentioned, claiming he wasn't talking about the university. But to my knowledge, he hasn't commented on Howard Zinn since then.
Well, I'm sure he'll probably want to see a copy of your book. He probably should take a look at them. Maybe Mr. Daniels won't.
Maybe. Who knows? I'm not sure what his reading habits are, but yeah.
Maybe Mr. Daniels won't, because he's already gone through that phase of his life, and he probably doesn't want to live that again, I would imagine so.
That's quite possible.
Professor David Detmer of the Purdue University Northwest Campus in Hammond is a professor of philosophy, and he's also the author of another book. He's written four other books before, but his latest book is entitled Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. And also, too, by the way, he serves as the current chairman of the Purdue University Northwest Faculty Senate. And Professor Detmer, thank you very much for being with us to talk about your book. And hope that a lot of people do manage to get a copy of it. If they have not known about Howard Zinn, learn something about the man, about his philosophy, and why it seemed to raise so many hairs on the back of Mitch Daniels' neck, apparently, when he learned about it the first time it came around. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The state is closer to finalizing its plan to address Indiana's wastewater and water needs. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Teal reports, the Water Infrastructure Task Force agreed on a draft report at its last meeting on Tuesday.
The list of recommendations is long. Among them, the committee recommended appointing someone to oversee water-related activities and study areas where communities can collaborate. It also suggests creating a new task force to look over things like stormwater runoff and water quality. State Senator Susan Glick co-chairs the committee.
I think we have a long way to go, and I think everyone here recognizes that the issues are not going to be confined to what we've included in our report. But again, it's a good first step.
How Indiana will pay for these billion-dollar improvements is still up in the air. But the report suggested using a state loan program that already helps communities with those costs. The draft of the report will now go to the Legislative Council. The task force hopes the state will implement the recommendations within 2 years. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Last year, more than 1,700 Hoosiers died from a drug overdose, the state's highest number ever. A new report from the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation breaks down the data. The state has implemented a number of new laws to address opioid misuse, and in turn, while the number of prescription overdoses has increased, deaths that have been tied to fentanyl use is also on the rise. The report finds that opioid use is the highest among 18 to 25-year-olds in Indiana. The statewide death rate for African Americans has doubled over the past 5 years. Fairbanks Foundation President and CEO Claire Fidian Green says there must be more done to address the crisis. She says the report recommends greater access to evidence-based treatment options, including medication-assisted treatment.
The evidence clearly show that people remain abstinent much longer, and they can more quickly return to a meaningful life where they are engaged and they are not in the throes of struggling with their addictions.
Other strategies include increasing prevention programs for young Hoosiers and expansion of harm reduction methods. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and welcome to Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Mark Rowe. He's the Senior Manager of Business Development for Trillium. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl.
I should say welcome back to the show. So, hey, Mark, tell our listeners, what is Trillium?
Well, Carl, thanks you again for having us. Trillium, we like to think of ourselves as a leading provider of renewable fuels and alternative fueling stations. We specialize in fuel supply, design, installation, and operation for those innovative energy solutions. Trillium's alternative fuel offerings include compressed natural gas, CNG as it's commonly referred to, hydrogen, and electric vehicle charging infrastructure, as well as low-carbon energy supply from renewable natural gas, solar installations, and on-site electricity generation. For more than 20 years, Trillium has delivered and designed superior quality, reliability, and dependability at more than 200 alternative fueling stations nationwide. We specialize in design, build, and operating these facilities and providing 24/7 maintenance services for various types of professional fleets and fleet operators.
Well, I know 200 sites across the United States, that's a huge undertaking. So I know, what is Trillium's relationship to a very well-known name here in northern Indiana, Love's Travel Stops?
Yes, we are very pleased to be a wholly owned subsidiary of the Love's family of companies. We were acquired in March of 2016, mm-hmm. and it's really been a great transition and a great company to work with and for. The folks at Love's and their other operating units are best in class at fuel delivery, logistics, and I think most importantly, finding innovative solutions for customers' needs. They've expanded by a number of locations, even in the short amount of time that we've been a part of their company. But they are up to over 500 total locations nationwide, and we certainly see more dots popping up on their map, if you will, here in the Midwest. It's an exciting company to be a part of.
So why did Trillium change its name from Trillium CNG to just Trillium this year?
Well, we really want to position ourselves as a one-stop shop for alternative fuels. We've got a history and really the expertise in CNG, and we've got all those design build projects and maintenance platforms that we operate today that I highlighted earlier. But we see the market shifting, and we see our customers catering to additional alternative fuels, and we see ourselves as the right company to lead in that space. So we believe our company name should fully reflect our offerings, and so we've kind of chopped off the CNG portion, and we're just Trillium now, and really by doing so, we want to highlight that we are an alternative fuels and renewable energy company, and adding those all fuel solutions like EV charging and hydrogen fueling to our portfolio, we're helping our customers reduce tailpipe emissions, and in doing so, we can pair those solutions with the renewable fuels that we have in our portfolio, and really look at reducing the total life cycle emissions profile of our customers.
You're listening to Green Fleet Radio on 89.1 The Lakeshore. Today, our guest is Mr. Mark Rowe, Senior Manager of Business Development for Trillium. So talk about some of the benefits of alternative fuels, Mark.
Yeah, I'll talk through, briefly on our product suite. Mm-hmm. I think we're just, again, to highlight, we're broadening our offerings to meet our customers' needs. We want to be out front of what's next in the alt fuel landscape. And in doing so, we're catering to all types of fuels across the spectrum of fleets, being from light duty to medium and heavy duty fleet operators that utilize both the Trillium sites and, mm-hmm. the Love's Travel Stop network. So, CNG is our historical offering. We've got a couple different sizes, if you will, for CNG. Small fleet operators. We've got a great, kind of back lot private solution where we're able to, look at an economical modular fueling system, ideal for first-time customers or those fleet operators that don't have hundreds of vehicles to look at an alternative fuel installation, if you will. From there, we've got an existing retail network of over 65 public access CNG stations nationwide. That number continues to grow. We've got a few projects here working in the Midwest that we hope to see open in the near future as well. And then we've got, forward-looking in CNG, we've got the ability to create a custom solution for our customers, whether that's behind the gate, private, or adding to our public station network. From an electrical vehicle charging standpoint, we can help fleets evaluate options like solar, battery storage, and other on-site generation options. By looking at on-site generation, you really can take charge of your power costs as a fleet operator. And over the long term, you can reduce the risk related to future changes in utility fees. We couple that with some of our renewable fuel options, and it's really helping fleets further their sustainability goals. A couple more to touch on. Hydrogen is an up-and-coming fuel. We see a lot of momentum in California and some OEMs, making investment in hydrogen technology. It is a zero-emission technology, and hydrogen can be an attractive choice for fleet managers and sustainability officers looking to green their fleet on a large scale. While the decision to convert to hydrogen may seem simple, the planning and financing of the fueling system and the design is not. Trillium, we assist our customers with that, with innovative and cost-effective solutions to these infrastructure challenges. Solar is certainly not a new concept, but something that we've gotten great success with across the Trillium and Loves network by adding solar arrays in a variety of fashions to our travel stops and to our customers' footprints. We've got a solar solution that we can tailor to your needs as a fleet or an operator with grant writing assistance available. And that, again, that design, construction, and maintenance expertise that we have across our fuel options. And then last, but certainly not least, is, on-site power generation. There is a lot of buzz with battery electric buses. How do we take that impact to the grid and make it work for that, that transit authority or that, that fleet operator running a large number of electric vehicles? So, here at Trillium, we've got that on-site power generation, dialed in. We've got several options that I think are good for operators to consider. And when you charge off the grid, you control your power supply and costs, which leads the way for improving capital and operational planning efficiency.
A lot of exciting things going on with Trillium. So how can our listeners learn more about Trillium, Mark?
A couple ways. You can check us out on our website, TrilliumCNG.com. You can check us out on the Loves website as well, Loves.com, or you can certainly reach out to me directly. I'm glad to be a resource for fleets or interested parties looking at alternative fuels. And my email is marc.rowe@loves.com, LOVES.com.
Well, Mark, keep up the great work. We look forward to having you on the future shows to give us updates on what's going on here in the Illinois, Indiana area. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mark Rowe, Senior Manager of Business Development for Trillium. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are available right now on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on this Halloween 2018 here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Belle Gunness was Northwest Indiana's notorious female serial killer. She lured potential victims to LaPorte, where the death count would rise. The locally produced movie, The Gunness Mystery, documents her killing spree.
Belle Annabelle Gunnus was born in Selbu, Norway. She was married on March 19th, 1884. Then, mysteriously, Mads died on July 30th, 1900. She traded her home for a 48-acre farm in LaPorte, Indiana. Peter and Belle were married by Pastor Moore. Peter also died under suspicious circumstances. Belle had been placing matrimonial ads in two Scandinavian newspapers. An unknown number of men read these ads and wrote to Belle. She said she would make life as happy as possible. They could come and stay forever.
The voice of Bruce Johnson, set to images by Stephen Raminski. The men behind creating the documentary, The Gunnus Mystery. Let's talk about how this movie came to be. It began with you and an interest, correct, Bruce?
Yeah, I've been researching her most of my life, but really got down to it in April of 2007 to get ready for the 100th anniversary.
And how did you do your research?
I'm on the board of directors of the museum in LaPorte, the LaPorte County Historical Society, and we have a file of all kinds of information about her, including actual photographs.
You have a general interest in history. You have a career based around it. Did you just have a particular interest in Belle Gunnus?
I have Scandinavian ancestry. My ancestors have worked with her and did business with her, and so that connection was what drew me to her.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, where did you come in? Because you were a big part of turning this into the movie.
Well, Bruce was doing an actual slide presentation around LaPorte County, and I went to one of them and saw what he was doing. And I'd known him a little bit locally from some plays and stuff. And I said, we could put this to DVD. And it was more, at the first thought, just putting it to DVD, but then it really became, we're actually making a documentary here. So, and over about 2.5 years, off and on working on it, we got it completed finally. But yeah, it was very, I was off to school for part of that, so we got to get together in the summers and whenever we could, and it took a lot of time, but eventually we got it done.
What was the approach? How did you want to approach it, turning it from a slideshow into a documentary? What was the goal?
Well, when you see it, you can do a lot more as a documentary than just, seeing a slide on a screen, because we can animate the photos to, focus in on certain parts and really, tell a story just by how we're moving the photo. So that was one aspect of it. And then adding music, sound effects, really bringing things to life a little bit more, and that's what we did. And really, our main goal as well was to stick strictly to the facts, the truth of what happened, everything we know, stay away from all the rumors.
And as I was preparing for your visit, I was asking some friends, some family, as well as coworkers about Belle Gunnus and their knowledge, and it's very interesting that there are still some, even though it happened right here in Northwest Indiana, that don't know about Belle Gunnus. Can you tell us a little bit about her story, Bruce?
She was born in Selbu, Norway in 1859, emigrated to Chicago in 1881 when she was 21 years old, got married there in 1884. Her first husband died mysteriously. She was not satisfied with his life insurance policy. It was too small, $3,500, so she asked him to take out a larger one for $5,000. And then, of all things, he died on the one day the two policies overlapped.
Very.
So she got $8,500.
Suspicious.
Very suspicious, yes.
It did not stop there.
No, she took that money, bought a farm in LaPorte, Indiana. On her farm, they discovered 13 bodies. And this was after a fire at her farm, a mysterious fire. Mm-hmm. And if you include all the foster children, two husbands, it comes out to 22 people altogether.
Wow.
That I know of. Yeah. I mean, there could be more,
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say.
Is the farm in LaPorte, is it still there?
It was divided. The property was divided up over the years, but there is still the original property where the house was located. In fact, a house was built on the original basement.
So the basement is still there,
yes.
And there is now a house occupied house?
Yes.
There?
Yes.
Now, are there any stories, any ghost stories of Belle or perhaps victims?
Yes. The family that lives there now, when they moved there from another community and didn't know the history of the house and the property, the little three-year-old boy who had a bedroom upstairs was talking to his friends all the time, and nobody else could understand who he was talking to.
Really?
Yes. So he had friends in his room.
Victims in the double digits, and you just had an interest in history in general and being at local history. I think as a society, it's clear we do have an interest or a fascination with serial killers. And her case is unusual because she was a female, first of all. And as I've been thinking about this, it was almost as if she was an internet predator before the internet. Mm-hmm. Because, explain the method, she would place ads, correct?
Right. She placed ads in three different newspapers, one in Chicago, one in Minneapolis, and one in Iowa. And these were ads advertising for a man who would be interested in becoming a partner in her farm.
And they were those were big Norwegian communities, or Scandinavian communities. That's why she placed them there. And they were all in
Norwegian. It was in Norwegian.
Yeah, Norwegian.
It's like the Craigslist of the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm, right.
Let's talk about, speaking with Bruce Johnson and Stephen Rominski, the men behind the locally produced documentary, The Guinness Mystery. In terms of notoriety, as I mentioned, talking with some friends, some family, some coworkers, still some people, even here in Northwest Indiana, that aren't aware of her. The region, so proud, it seems, at times, of its connection to John Dillinger. But when you think of Belle Guinness and the evil that surrounded her, she was way more badass than John Dillinger.
Oh, definitely.
So why are there people that still don't know about her? Are there other books? Have there been other movies about her?
There's been a couple of books written over the years about her case. And at the time, in 1908, when everything was, you know, becoming uncovered, it was huge. There was thousands upon thousands of people flocked to La Porte to tour the farm site to see all the graves and the bodies. It's really odd. And it was in the New York Times regularly with updates on the case and what happened. So it definitely was there at the moment. It just kind of has been forgotten by history a little, just over the years, you know. These other serial killers have come about, and there wasn't the mass media there is now, where if something like this happened, you know, everyone would know about it in minutes on Twitter or something. So,
with the advancement of forensics technology in general, were there still many, many years afterwards that they were able to unsolve this case, even now as you had done your research, Bruce?
Well, in 2007, I was with when there was an exhumation of a body in Chicago, which supposedly is hers. The body of the woman that was found in the fire and the three children were buried in Forest Home Cemetery in Oak Park, Illinois.
Supposedly Belle's.
Right.
Okay.
And they did an exhumation of her body in 2007. And it was the body we were looking for because it did not have a head. And that's part of the mystery, is we don't know whose body it is without a head.
Sure.
And I think that's one thing, too, that this is, the case was never solved. So
it could have been Belle, but also skeptics might think she could have been out there for quite some time afterwards.
She's probably disappeared.
When you know the full story, if you see the documentary, you more than likely believe she wasn't in the fire. She filled her will out the day before.
Really?
Yeah. She got her will made the day before. The head, there's no head there. They found her teeth, conveniently enough, but they never found a head. So it's most likely she got away, and now, you know, we never know, really.
And that's why it's the Guinness Mystery, mm-hmm. because it is a mystery story. Now, how, you think in the late 1800s, when there were no rights, really, it seemed, or not as many for, there wasn't women empowerment like mm-hmm. it is around today. Mm-hmm. Thinking about a female serial killer back then, it's really baffling. How would she have been able to kill all of these men, really?
Well, they would answer her ads. The newspaper would notify her, and then she would correspond with them. In fact, one of the last victims, she wrote 80 letters to him before he finally came to LaPorte 2.5 years later. So that's how she did it. She wrote to them, they corresponded back and forth, and finally they would decide whether or not to come and visit her.
And because of all this insurance money she'd accrued, and she'd been able to get the farm, and she was running a fairly successful farm, you know, she didn't have to... She had her own independence, really. She could have these guys come to the farm. They'd be in town for a few days. No one would know any better why they were there. And that was they wouldn't tell anyone where they were going. That was one of her stipulations, you know, bring everything you own. Tell no one where you're coming. Bring it all in cash. Sew it into your underwear. And, you know,
Wow. We'll
keep this to ourselves. So,
but would she have some sort of trademark? I mean, like, did she kill them a specific way?
As far as we know, she poisoned them first with arsenic and strychnine. And then when they were drowsy from the poison, she would hit them over the head, probably with a hammer or something, crack their skulls, and then they died that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she would cut them up, and cut off their heads, arms, and legs, and then put them in a gunny sack in the basement until it was time to get help to bury them.
Hmm, okay. And they were able to tell all this probably from when they found these bodies, these buried bodies?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I know that some of these bodies are also featured. Are they featured during the documentary? Mm-hmm. Are there some pretty grim scenes?
There's pretty graphic photos, yeah.
Okay.
They're pretty, you know, yeah, they're pretty gruesome photos, but there's not a lot of them, and it's pretty easy to look at. I don't know. We've seen them a lot over the years in LaPorte. So
I'm sure you've
everyone knows what they are. And like, oh, that's that guy's head. And you see the big crack and it's just a head sitting on the table.
Right.
And it's a little odd maybe if you're not accustomed to it like we are now. But
we're hoping to teach people about the story because, like you say, people haven't known the story. It's sort of disappeared over the years. I don't know why, but hopefully they'll learn some things that they never knew before.
Watching horror movies, part of fun Halloween tradition for many, but there's an abundance of scary movies out there too, and many people have different preferences for different reasons. It's nearly impossible to narrow down the top quintessential horror movies and their right answers or wrong answers as to what they are. And just the same, Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson sought out a professional critic's opinion, and she talked with Dave Canfield. He's the movie critic for Screen Anarchy and is a member of the Chicago Film Critics Association. Here's the conversation.
So what I've done is I picked five movies that fall into different general categories. I picked an old black and white film. I picked a lost gem that I'm pretty sure none of your listeners have ever heard of, but they can get a hold of. I have a new film on the list, a film I think is the best horror movie of the year. And I have two foreign films, one of which is a found footage film. So this is a pretty diverse list. So first up is an old black and white film from 1957. It's called Night of the Demon. You know, when we think of the 1950s, we don't really think of horror movies. We think of sci-fi movies and big bugs invading cities and the creature from the Black Lagoon and things like that, sort of nominal horror films, but also, you know, science fiction, aliens, that kind of thing. Night of the Demon is an exception, and it's easily the best horror film of the 1950s. It's directed by a guy named Jacques Tournier, who worked with Val Lewton, who made all those incredible sort of films in the 1940s where you didn't necessarily get to see the monster, but you knew the monster was always in the background.
Police say that Professor Harrington was electrocuted.
He did a series of those for RKO. They're considered classics by people like Martin Scorsese. But Jacques Tournier went off and he did this on his own, and it's about a skeptic who is called in to investigate an occultist.
I have an imagination like anyone else. It's easy to see a demon in every dark corner. But I refuse to let this thing take possession of my good senses. If this world is ruled by demons and monsters, we may as well give up right now.
Who claims to be able to do real magic. And he's called in to investigate this after a colleague of his dies. And he has this sort of cat and mouse back and forth with the occultist. It stars Dana Andrews as the guy who's doing the investigating, and a guy named Niall McGuinness, who was just one of the great character actors of all time. You do get to see the monster in this film, and some people think it's kind of hokey. Some people think it's really scary, but one thing that is really scary in this film, besides there are a few really scary sequences, but it definitely has one of the scariest hypnotist sequences ever in film. Moving on, I have a lost gem. I highly recommend it. It's called Close Your Eyes. It's from 2002.
Close your eyes. Warren Visnick plays a hypnotist who gets drawn into a murder case involving a child.
Think only nice thoughts. No more little girls floating underwater, okay?
And from there into another game of occult cat and mouse. And you will be really surprised where this film winds up. It's quite violent in parts. It's very shocking in parts. And it also stars the great Shirley Henderson, who played Moaning Myrtle, the toilet ghost in the Harry Potter movies. Cannot recommend it highly enough. It's one of those films that flew under the radar and went almost immediately onto DVD. I recommend getting these DVDs before they go out of print, because when they do, you're going to have a very hard time finding this movie. On the news side, I recommend Hereditary.
It's heartening to see so many strange new faces here today. I know my mom would be very touched.
It is the best horror film of 2018. It has been a great last couple of years for horror movies. It's part expertly acted family drama. I wouldn't be surprised if Toni Collette, the star, was nominated for an Oscar this year.
My mother was a very secretive and private woman.
It's a directorial debut, and that in and of itself is absolutely amazing. When you watch this film, it never occurs to you this is a first-time director. And it's also part occult horror thriller, and it's really, really gruesome in spots, so that's kind of a warning. I would say the only film that I would like readily show to almost any child would be Night of the Demon on this list, but all the other ones I would be kind of careful with. They can be pretty intense. So if you don't mind gruesome thrills and you don't mind really unsettling stuff but has some potentially triggering family drama scenes in it, I can't recommend this movie enough. The last two films on my list are foreign films. One is called The Wailing.
이렇게 소문이 받아온 말이요? 무슨 이유가 있는 거요? 이유가...
It came out in 2016, and it made a pretty big splash, but it's one of those films that's sort of fallen by the wayside. You have to kind of be in for the long haul. It's 2 hours and 26 minutes long. It has a lot of characters in it. That makes it, I think, the longest horror movie ever made. It's definitely the best Korean horror movie ever made. It's about a policeman. He's investigating a series of murders in his small town and comes to find out that his lead suspect may or may not be human. It is really, really full, again, of family drama balanced against very unsettling sequences of, you know, that involve a lot of occult type imagery. And the interesting thing about it is, instead of just going for cheap thrills, what they do is they show you how everyone's story arc in the film sort of inexorably leads to a specific point that'll leave you very, very, very unsettled by the time it's all over. The Wailing. I really recommend that film. And last is a film called Wreck. And Wreck is part of a series of four films. It came out in 2007, and it's by the great director Wame Balearos. You may know him from some of his stateside thrillers. He's done some work with Leslie Nielsen. But I chose to go with Wreck because it just came out in a beautiful, nice Blu-ray box set from Scream Factory, and it's one of the best found footage movies ever made. It is basically about this reporter who goes to a fire station to do a story on what it's like to be a fireman. And they get called to an apartment building. They enter the apartment building, and then they are quarantined in the apartment building because of something that's happened there. If you think you know where this movie is headed, you are wrong. Man, is it a fun movie to introduce party guests to. Definitely will elicit some yells. Definitely will have people hiding their eyes. Those are my picks for Halloween. Again, coming out of an ocean of great horror cinema. For me, every day is Halloween, but I don't get to do this every day.
Thanks to Dave Canfield, movie critic for Screen Anarchy and member of the Chicago Film Critics Association. I'm Sharon Jackson for Lakeshore Public Radio.
Many expect Indiana's U.S. Senate campaign to go down to the wire this November between Democrat incumbent Joe Donnelly and Republican challenger Mike Braun. Libertarian Lucy Brenton could have an impact on such a tight race. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith spoke with Brenton about her goals and the reasons for running.
How would you view being a U.S. senator as a libertarian?
As a libertarian, my job in the U.S. Senate would really to be to return us to constitutional values. The very first thing that I would do is look at what laws have been passed that are unconstitutional and work towards repealing those. We must go back to the master contract that governs this country, and that's the Constitution.
How do you envision doing that as presumably one libertarian among 99 other Republicans and Democrats for the most part?
It's funny because I also see my role there as a referee, to be somebody that can cross the line and say, let's work together. Because when the Republicans work with the Democrats, it's usually for something that's going to collude against the American public, increase taxes, you know, get those Christmas tree bills that are so famous passed. But my job as a libertarian would bring people to the point of consensus on freedom.
There's been a lot of discussion in this campaign about sort of how you represent Hoosiers when it comes to working with President Trump. How would you view your role as it comes to working with President Trump in D.C.?
My role would then be to hold him back from doing the things that are unconstitutional. My role is to hold people to the Constitution. That's the master contract. I think what we saw in the debate on October 8th was Senator Donnelly trying to prove how Republican he is, and of course Senator Braun with the ACA trying to prove how Democrat he is. What they're proving is that they are more of the same.
How do you define success when it comes to this sort of the tariffs that have been in play over the last year and a half?
How are these subsidies that are given to replace the money lost by tariffs affecting the average individual? The average Hoosier is paying multiple times for that tariff, first in the price of corn, then in the price of the subsidies to the farmers. So it's absolutely unacceptable that we're being stolen from at every level. I believe in zero corporate income taxes. The reason our jobs are being outsourced is so that we can keep prices low by not having as many corporate taxes included in the price. Having corporate taxes of zero would allow our corporations to stay in this country, keep prices low.
How do you replace the money that would be lost by zeroing out those taxes?
The money isn't lost anywhere. The money is simply in the consumer's hands instead of the government's. So if I pay $10 for a product instead of $15 because of the taxes, now the consumer pays $10 and the other $5 stays in the consumer's pocket where it belongs.
There's also the issue of health care. Is there any role for government in health care in your mind?
There is no role in government for health care in my mind. When government enters a market, it disrupts it. It's an unseen hand that moves prices up. When you take people out of the position of actually paying for their own health care, they don't know how much it costs. I'll use myself as an example. When I worked for the phone company, I had amazing insurance. I had a birth baby number 7 that was over $15,000, and I literally did not have even an aspirin. There was no OBGYN there. It was a midwife-assisted birth. But yet with my baby number 9, born at home, that baby was $4,000. That's it. It's an $11,000 cost differential because there's no competition and you are insulated from the cost by the insurance companies. Do you want to know why your premiums are so high? That's it. It's that $1,000 aspirin.
If you remove government entirely from healthcare, though, doesn't that put everything in the hands of the insurance companies? And is that what people want?
No, it puts it back in the hands of the consumer and the provider where it should be.
The tax reform bill. Something that Mike Braun obviously supports, something that Joe Donnelly says was bad for this country in the long term. If you had been in the U.S. Senate when the tax reform bill came up, how would you have voted?
I will vote for anything that increases freedom and reduces costs, so I would have voted for it, but I don't think it went far enough. When I reviewed it, it looked like Trump took 35% to 21%, you know, from 35% to 21% on the corporate income tax. That's great. That means that consumers are going to pay less, but it's not nearly good enough.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you.
Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, Lucy Brenton, speaking with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith. Time now for an opportunity to talk with your furry friend, Ollie. He's in the studio to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. Those pet questions voiced by woman-human, Victoria Voller, and answers are done by man-human, Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Tom, we got a letter today from Laddie, who's been at the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana in Miller for quite a while. I think he has a home. We do usually move our dogs within 90 days. We certainly tried to, and we've been very lucky to have been able to do it. So here's what he says. Hi, I'm Laddie, and I've been parked at the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana shelter in Miller for months. I've just been looking for a new home. Well, I find myself in a great place right now. Two ladies adopted me from the Humane Society as an only dog. And you know what that means. That means I am the center of attention. Before I joined my new family, the shelter had me groomed and neutered. I prefer the grooming, although it includes a horrible spray water bath that some good citizen paid to have done. And I'm not real high on the neutering thing either. So here's my story. My original owner gave me to somebody else, a construction dude from Porter County. He said he cared for me, but he didn't pay for my rabies shot or neutering job and abandoned me at a Lucky Stop convenience store in Valparaiso. That same dude told the clerk that he didn't have the heart to take me to a shelter to be killed. But the real reason I found myself resting on a bed behind the lottery tickets was he just couldn't handle me anymore. Really? I only weigh 9 pounds. Wait just a minute here. I'm a snappy-looking male black and white Pomeranian. I'm guessing the guy weighed way more than me and was smarter. I mean, humans usually are. So what couldn't he handle? While I was at the shelter, another male 6-year-old cocker was brought in, too, as an owner surrender. The woman gave him up, saying, I can't deal with him marking territory and humping everything, so he's yours. Haven't these humans ever heard of neutering a male dog? I admit, the neutering idea freaked me out, but I feel great now with more energy. I'll run away less, and my marking and humping days are over. Plus, I'm pretty sharp looking with the grooming job they did, and I found a new home. I feel lucky today, like winning the lottery. What's not to like? Signed, Laddie, the abandoned Pomeranian from Morgan Township.
Dear Laddie, it's very good news to hear that you have a chance at a new life. I'm a private person kind of dog, but I will share with you that I've been neutered too. We are a domesticated species and differ from our wild ancestors in several ways. First and foremost, we socialize with people and have been bred to have higher reproductive rates. Dogs and cats both are sexually mature at an earlier age than our wild counterparts. It's not something I talk about a lot, but my testicles were removed. They are very gone. Ugh, castration. And neutering is a nice way to say it. I sometimes daydream about what used to be there, but most of the time I'm content knowing there are behavioral and medical benefits to this procedure. Neutered dogs are less likely to have aggression problems, less likely to roam from home and mark their territory with urine. Those behaviors do not endear pets to people. If you have a dog that weighs 40 pounds or more and can't afford to go to a private veterinarian to get him or her fixed, call Calumet Snap toll-free at 877-819-3300. They have financial aid to help you get your large dog fixed. Their website is calumetsnap.org. Signed, Ollie, your neutered friend in fur. And remember, love is a four-legged word.
If you have a question for your friend and for Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we have with us from Side Effects Public Media, reporter Lauren Bavis. We'll revisit our conversation with Indianapolis Star columnist Matt Tully, and we'll also have in studio Region Immigration Attorney Alfredo Estrada. Hope you can join us.